two of them are being submitted today on the briefs without oral argument. Those two cases are Appeal Number 06-3288, Wright v. Merit System Protection Board, and Appeal Number 06-1486, Klein v. Topin. Also submitted on the briefs today, although originally scheduled for argument, will be Appeal Number 06-1366, Teledyne Technology v. Western Skyways. The panel with two cases for oral argument will hear argument first in Barnes v. United States, Appeal Number 06-5030. Mr. Mix, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Welcome. Please proceed.
May it please the Court. The Secretary of the Navy, acting for the President, determined that Mr. Barnes' misconduct warranted his removal from the promotion list to Lieutenant Commander.
We've been to briefs. We understand how he got here.
In the trial court, we believe erred in several findings below. One, we believe that the Navy acted in accordance with the statute when it did remove Mr. Barnes from the promotion list. And therefore, we don't even need to reach the DICER promotion by operational law issue. The court below erred in four instances. Initially, we believe the court erred when it determined that the Secretary of the Navy did not have a basis for delaying Mr. Barnes' promotion in 1998. We believe that that report of non-judicial punishment, where Mr. Barnes was found to have committed five violations of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, was the kind of misconduct that the Secretary of the Navy could consider that possibly Mr. Barnes wasn't professionally or morally capable for promotion to the next highest grade.
I didn't understand the other side to have argued, or the trial judge to have held, that the conduct in question was irrelevant to the promotion decision. I understood the argument made by Mr. Fidel and accepted by Judge Merrow to be that there were procedural defaults so that procedures that would justify delay that are in the statutes or the Navy regulations were not followed. And that as a result of those procedural defaults, the later actions by various Navy officials were tainted and therefore not lawful. So it seems to me your burden here is to persuade us that either there were no defaults, the rules were all followed, or that even if they weren't followed, it had no effect on the result, that it was, if error, harmless error. And instead, you seem to be arguing, well, he was a bad guy and he was found guilty of having done some unfortunate things, which everybody agrees with that. That's not what the dispute is here before us today.
But, Your Honor, we respectfully disagree in that opinion below did say that that was the first error and that there wasn't a basis once the non-judicial punishment had concluded to delay the promotion, effectively reading 10 U.S.C. 624 D1C, which deals with misconduct alone. We always have maintained that the delay was made pursuant to 10 U.S.C. 624 D2, and that is when the Secretary may delay any promotion where an officer is determined to be an officer, possibly to be mentally, morally, or professionally unqualified for promotion. That was the first error we believe that the trial court found. The trial court also found other errors, absolutely true. The first one they believed in that when they provided notice to Mr. Barnes, the statute says that a promotion can only, must, that a person who's scheduled for promotion must be notified of that promotion prior to the effective date, unless notification is impracticable. In this case, notification by the Secretary of the Navy was sent on March 17th to Mr. Barnes, who was located in Japan.
By mail?
By mail, yes, Your Honor.
Who gets to decide whether it's impractical? Is that a question of fact that we would defer to some fact finding to determine whether or not the facts and circumstances made it impractical? Or is that a question of law that we need to find?
Well, in this case, we believe that that decision should be deferred. There should be deference to the Navy because it's not a defined term. It doesn't.
Where does the Navy make a decision that it was impractical?
Well, the Navy's decision that it was impractical was made by the commanding officer at Misawa in Japan, who determined that, though he did receive the notification late, that he wasn't going to send it to Mr. Barnes, who was deployed in the Arabian Gulf. He would wait until Mr. Barnes came back to
onshore. But the executive officer didn't find that it was impracticable, the word of the statute in the reg. The executive officer simply wrote that he was concerned that if he mailed the letter, by the time it got to the ship, Lieutenant Barnes might be off the ship, and therefore not able to receive the letter. The argument made by the other side is, forget about mail. They emailed him the notice of the Board of Inquiry while he was on the ship, and therefore they equally could have emailed him the notice of the delay. And so the emailing of the Board of Inquiry notice proves that the Navy isn't dependent on what some people derisively call snail mail, postal service type mail. So it seems to me we don't have a finding by anybody, including the commanding officers in the field in Japan, that they were unable, I'll translate impracticable to unable, to get word to him on the ship.
But in this case, Your Honor, the Navy felt, or this, it appears that the Navy wanted to give the notification to Mr. Barnes in person. Because,
why?
For one is, he had acknowledged receipt, and more importantly, once he acknowledged
receipt. He didn't acknowledge receipt by email, come on.
But that also started the 15-day timeline for him to respond.
So,
and if you notify him via email on the ship while he's out on an exercise, there's no telling if, in fact, he had legal counsel available to help him. In fact, that's what the Navy officer, in his email response back to the Secretary of the Navy, said. He has now been personally notified that he's meeting with his counsel to provide a response. So, in a sense, by delaying notification, it actually assisted Mr. Barnes. Because once
he... It may be that it was more helpful to him because it gave him more time and it gave him shoreside access to lawyers. But the regulation doesn't talk about what's more advantageous to the officer. The regulation or the statute seem to give the officer a right to pre-appointment date notice unless he can't be reached. And so the issue would seem to be, could he have been reached while he was still on the ship? Yes or no? Not which is more beneficial to him, wait and give it to him later in person versus send it by email.
And the commanding officer in this case decided that he did not want to send it by email and wanted to give it to him in person. There was nothing that sets out a checklist for a commanding officer to follow. In this case, he made an operational decision that for this sailor under his command, he would wait the extra week or two to provide him the notice in person so he'd acknowledge it in person and then have the benefit of counsel available.
It wasn't an extra week or two. At least if I recall the dates correctly, the letter was dispatched by the Pentagon on March 17th, and Lieutenant Barnes got it on April 23rd, more than a month later. So when you say a week or so delay, that's just not accurate.
Well, when the commanding officer received the letter. And in this case, the services always, historically have always done military justice in person. They don't.
Isn't a Board of Inquiry as related to the underlying misconduct here as the promotion proceedings?
Well, it is, but...
Well, again, if they emailed him about the Board of Inquiry, they weren't worried about privacy or embarrassment or other such factors. So what's different about a notice of the delay in the promotion? Why is that more sensitive?
Again, Your Honor, our position is that by giving him personal notice that there was a specific temporal block on that for 15 days to provide comment. Once he received that notice, therefore he had the 15 days and he was able to provide a response with assistance of counsel. That's what the Navy decided to do in this situation.
Is it your view that because it was a decision made by the executive officer of his unit in Japan, that we're absolutely bound by it, regardless of the soundness of the decision, just because it was made in the field by a Navy line commander? You're the executive officer of the unit.
Well, unless it's completely unreasonable, in this case...
Well, what's your authority that the standard of review is completely unreasonable?
In that, one is, there has to be...
Specific question. Is there some authority that says our standard of review of such a determination is completely unreasonable?
I don't have an authority, but the authority then would be, it's an arbitrary and capricious standard. And because this court reviews below that it's arbitrary and capricious where there's no basis in fact, and once again, it's like with most type claims when you're reviewing the decision of a military officer who made a decision, it's not whether I might have sent an email or maybe Commander Leary might have sent an email, it's just what did that officer do at the time he received that email, and was he justified in doing that? Was it reasonable? In this case, I don't see how we can second guess that officer. You have an officer deployed on an exercise.
Is the standard unreasonableness or impracticability? And isn't there a difference?
We would argue that if the standard being impracticable still is a lesser burden, is a less burden for the government to show in this case.
Well, suppose we agree with you, whether we will or not, who knows, but suppose we were to agree with you that it was sufficiently impracticable to immediately notify him that the Navy people involved were justified in waiting until he got back to his home base in Japan. And that would mean that the notice met the requirement of the statute or regulation. But what about the extension of that delay that was effected in August by other Navy officials?
Well, that was another area the court found. We would first look at the initial delay, where when the chief of Naval Bureau of Personnel on March 17th sent the initial delay, he said that all administrative and disciplinary proceedings are completed. And then it comes in August.
Doesn't the statute provide that that kind of initial notice expires at 6 months?
Yeah, from
and,
the date.
And the action here occurred well after, that is, the removal from the promotion list occurred well after the 6 months. So an extension of delay was necessary here.
And there was an initial delay. On the March, our position is on March 17th.
Do you agree or not agree that the March letter could only delay the promotion action for 6 months?
Yes.
And do you agree that the actual final promotion action by Secretary Danzig occurred later than 6 months?
Yes, but there was a second extension.
Okay, so then you have to show that the second extension was valid. The first extension doesn't get you as far as you need to get, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and then tell us why the second action, the August delay action, was valid.
Because
despite the fact that Judge Mero found that that August action was not valid.
Because on August 24th, Assistant Secretary of the Navy Rosker
approved
the ratification, realizing that the Board of Inquiry met. While they recommended retention of Mr. Barnes, they still found 3-0 that he committed the misconduct and 3-0 that his performance was substandard. And though they recommended retention, they couldn't make a decision whether to remove him. In fact, in their charter, they specifically stated that your only recommendation must be limited to the retention, and therefore there was still another action out there.
You should deal with what Mr. Fidel argues. He argues that the August delay action, the extension of the original six-month delay, was defective because no notice was given to Mr. Barnes.
There's no requirement that there
was. Well, then that should be your answer. They're not required to give notice.
There's no requirement to give notice. And
the
other argument,
he says, and you should respond to this, that D3 in the statute requires notice of any delay, original delay or extension of delay. First delay or second delay would require notice. Obviously, your position is no, it doesn't. But he says, well, look, the way it's worded, it just says delay. If there's delay, there has to be notice.
Well, only the initial, pursuant to the statute, D3 is the only language of the statute that requires initial notice, written notice, is the initial delay. The second delay, there's no mention of written notice. The other argument he makes is that
don't go so fast. As I understand it, the reason that notice is required is so the officer affected can write to high-level Navy officials and give his side of the story, right?
Yes, and he did.
Oh, okay, and he did, because he ultimately got the first notice.
Right, there's nothing in the record that shows that Mr. Barnes wasn't provided with every opportunity in the regulation to provide comment, to the secretary or the board of inquiry or anyone else, and in fact, he even was able to write his congressman, every due process step that's provided for by statute or regulation was followed in this case.
Isn't the notice requirement notice of the grounds for delay as opposed to notice of the delay?
And the initial notice did provide the grounds for delay. It said, because of your non-judicial punishment, we're going to review your record to determine if you should be promoted to the next highest grade. And it went along parallel tracks. The Navy did this in order, first to see if the sailor or the officer should be retained in service. Because if the BOI Board of Inquiry recommended that he should be separated, we wouldn't necessarily even get to the next step for promotion. Once they found that he should be retained, but not at the next highest grade, then it's back into the secretary's office for him to determine if, in fact, Mr. Barnes's misconduct warranted promotion to the next highest
grade. Let me ask you another question. The Court of Federal Claims held that the name may be removed from the promotion list only during a period of delay. And there's a lot of argument about the fact that the removal from the promotion list is only effective if it was during the period of delay. If the delay was inappropriate or not in accordance with the regulations, then the removal is not appropriate. But as I read Section 624D4, the delegated right of the president to remove someone from the promotion list is unfettered. Why is it that throughout these proceedings there's the discussion about the removal could only be effective during a period of delay?
Well, that was our initial argument to the court, that pursuant to this court's holding in Dysart, once there would be, I agree, Your Honor, there's the president's decision to remove an officer is unfettered. Once he was removed by statute, that is tantamount to a non-select.
Well, that's really what I'm getting at here, because I mean, what difference then does it matter whether the delay was in accordance with the proceedings or not? Because ultimately, he failed with selection.
That was our position below. The court did not agree with it. We argued below that because the president had, or the secretary had removed him, tantamount to a non-select, the second time his records were considered by a promotion board, and Mr. Barnes was not selected for promotion. By statute, 10 U.S.C. 632, Mr. Barnes shall be discharged within 7 months of that decision. And we argue that. We're saying by finding that you could review the removal matter, you're basically giving no consequence to that non-select, to that removal.
I mean, I suppose the regulations that talk about removal only during a period of delay reflected the status of things prior to Dysart, because presumably if you were not removed, you would be promoted by operation of law.
And possibly Congress thought the same way, because in the recent National Defense Authorization Act, in Section 515, I believe, they've amended this statute, and they basically said, well, they didn't basically, they did say, if you are not promoted within 18 months, you're removed.
But let me ask, I mean, that's what I was a little confused about. The court claims, it seems, to get around Dysart on the first three allegations and go to the fourth. The court of claims says that the fact that you can't compel appointment does not lead to the conclusion that courts are powerless to examine the legality of the process leading up to that refusal. Is it the government's view that the courts are powerless after Dysart to examine the process leading up to that refusal?
That was the language of Dysart, because they said that even Congress or the Secretary could not encumber the President's decision to appoint.
So, in your view, irrespective of what procedural violations might occur, there's no relief or no reviewability as to those issues?
In certain cases, there could be relief, but not in this case. And the reason I'm saying that, Your Honor, time is way over. I apologize to the court. For instance, let's assume that maybe the secretary didn't act on the removal, where there actually wasn't the person wasn't properly removed because of an improper authority that did the removal. Let's say it was a flag officer, a general officer, or the Secretary of the Navy removed the individual versus the president. Then obviously the court could look at that matter because that violated the statute, violated the Constitution, because in that case only the president has the president.
But you're saying, so let's look at a case though where at the end of the day it was the person whose authority, whose presidential authority, who was delegated the president's authority, made the ultimate decision to remove from the list. End of story. No,
that's our
review of
that's our position, and that's been the position of this court from Darko to Dysart to recently in Commander Lewis's case.
So then are you saying that, assuming that the official who removed somebody from a promotion list had authority to do so, that no failures to follow statutorily required procedures could have any effect?
I don't want to say no statute, but in this case, when the only error were temporal, alleged temporal errors, then we believe that's right.
You must be saying that there are two kinds of procedural errors. Some are really important and some are not so important. And if it's a not so important procedural error, then the removal from promotion list action stands. But if it's a more important procedural error, maybe it doesn't stand. Right?
No, because... Well, it depends what does stand mean, Your Honor, and that is if stand means that the person gets promoted by operation of law, we don't agree with that statement. The president's authority to appoint is unfettered.
But the point I'm trying to get clarity on is whether you're dividing failures to follow procedures and regulations and statutes to sometimes be important and sometimes not be important, depending on what the particular procedural requirement is.
Yes, that's true.
And you're saying that the March notice was an unimportant procedural requirement, and therefore it can't lead to invalidation of later Navy actions. Right?
Well, we wouldn't say that it was unimportant because the March notice, we think, did comply. I mean, that started the whole process.
Well, if we agree with you that there was compliance, then the rest of the analysis becomes a moot point.
Right.
Well, if we don't agree with you and we find that there was an error in the March notice, then the question becomes, all right, well, what's the effect of that error? I understand you to be saying it has no effect because it's just a timing thing. It's not very important.
In this case, that's right. It has no... Well, of course, we would argue that the Navy did not commit errors, but if it were this reason why they did, at best, they were harmless when it comes to the rights of Mr. Barnes and whether he was able to respond.
But doesn't the statute require notice?
That starts the process, yes, Your Honor.
But I mean, it's in the statute, not just in a regulation.
Right, yes, Your Honor.
Now, are you suggesting that statute has been impliedly invalidated by our decision in ISAR?
Well, it's part of the 18-month court, the portion in D4 certainly was invalidated by Dysar, in that Captain Dysar was not, the decision on Captain Dysar's promotion, unlike Mr. Barnes, was at far after 18 months, and the statute specifically says that 18 months after they would otherwise have been appointed, he shall be appointed. So, at least as far as the notice, or at least as far as that time period in the statute, Dysar clearly...
My question was whether D3, the notice provision relevant to this case, has been invalidated by Dysar. I don't understand what you're
saying. No, in that case, no. That's
okay.
Right, Rob.
So it's a valid statutory provision, but either you complied with it, or if you didn't, it was harmless anyway.
Yes, Your Honor.
And what does harmless mean in this context? So if it's harmful, I mean, if it has some impact, then you follow it? I mean, how does the principle of Dysar, which is that the president has the authority unfettered to appoint or not appoint, reconcile with the standard you have for important procedural errors or not?
The harmless error in this case goes to not, well, of course, Mr. Barnes was harmed because he wasn't promoted.
That's what Mr. Fidel argues. What do you argue?
Our argument is that that is the necessary consequence of the Secretary's decision, but he wasn't harmed in the process because he was given every due process right as far as being able to get notice and respond throughout the whole affair, whether it was at the BOI, he was offered counsel, he was offered an in-person hearing, he was offered...
He certainly had lots of opportunities. He wrote letters, and we have all those documents and facts fairly in mind, I think, but I'm not sure still what your position is in response to Judge Lynn's question of whether removals can only lawfully occur during statutorily permitted periods of delay. I thought you said, yes, that's true. They can only occur during statutorily permitted periods of delay.
That's true.
So even if Barnes had 100 opportunities and wrote 100 letters, if, in his case, the delays were not proper, then the removal would also be not proper, right?
Oh, yeah. Because I believe that I may be confusing the example, but the first example dealt with notice, which starts the process. The second example that you just provided dealt with timeliness issues. And we know from, as I said again, Dysart, Lewis, recent Lewis case, even Darko, that if there are errors during the temporal errors during the process of removal, that will not have any consequence on the ultimate removal.
Are you saying that pre-Dysart, that if the delay was not proper, then the officer would have been promoted by operation of law?
No, because Darko...
And therefore, the only appropriate removal action is one that would take place during a period of delay. Otherwise, the officer would have automatically been promoted. But now, in light of Dysart, since the president's discretion is unfettered, if the president, through his delegated officer, removes someone from the promotion list, then that is effective regardless of whether the delay was proper or not.
Dysart certainly clarified that point, but I think this court's holding in Darko also supported the conclusion that there was no such thing as promotion by operation of law.
I don't know that that's the issue here, because the alternative relief that Mr. Fidel sought to obtain from the trial court and was trying to maintain here, the alternative relief is restoration at his former rank of lieutenant, not lieutenant commander, first lieutenant. And I don't understand what your response is to that.
Our response is, by statute, Mr. Barnes was required to be removed, because the second time his records were considered for promotion, he was not selected.
Well, we all know that consequence has to follow. But the whole argument of the other side and the rulings of the court below was there weren't two valid passovers, because the first passover was invalid. Therefore, the removal was not proper.
And we respectfully disagree that
the discharge.
We respectfully disagree with that decision, and the reason being is because the Secretary determined that, one, we think that the Navy followed its rules, the regulations, and there was a proper notice, proper delay, proper ratification of the delay. Secondly, we also contend that because the Secretary, acting for the President, obviously removed Mr. Barnes, the consequence of that removal, by statute, is non-selection. So the second time Mr. Barnes' records were reviewed and he was not selected, the statute required and the regulation required.
Where in Dysart do we hold anything more than Constitution precludes promotion by operation of law, since only the president can promote? simply held no promotion by operation of law. It didn't say anything about timeliness regulations being voided by constitutional force.
That was the, that was the effect of Dysart, though, because in, at least in Dysart, unlike this case.
And maybe in the eyes of the beholder, that's what you think somehow embedded in Dysart. I don't see that at all.
In our briefs below, we cited, I know we cited, and if I have some time.
Maybe, let me,
maybe I can try to answer and see if it makes any sense, or if you would disagree with me. I asked myself the same question in reviewing the briefs and cases, and the only thing that I could find, and I'm not sure which, whether it was responsive to Judge Rousseau's question, is that in Dysart, there were underlying allegations of procedural violations. And somewhere in Dysart, as I recall, the court sort of says, because we reached this issue, that sort of gets rid of all of the other allegations with respect to delays and so forth. Is that responsive at all?
I believe that I can find the passage on rebuttal and provide it to the court. Thank you.
No, but, all right, so thank you, counsel. We'll restore your rebuttal time, Mr. Fidel. Welcome and good morning. Before you proceed, would you explain to us, just as a, in a commonsensical sort of way, where are we now? Did former Lieutenant Barnes have the Special Selection Board to re-review the Passover in 2002? Did he get any credits toward retirement or not? What is the real stake in this case? Are we really talking about his ability to retire and get a Navy pension? Is that the practical
effect? What a wonderful practical question.
What are the answers?
The answer is as follows. Number one, despite the fact that there's been no stay pending appeal, the Navy never did call Mr. Barnes back to active duty. So that's as far as that is concerned. By our calculations, affording him constructive credit, which is the part of the customary relief in these cases, he would have gone over 20 years, which for a lieutenant is the retirement trigger, in February of 2006.
But in fact, he's not presently receiving retired Navy
pay. Not a penny.
So apparently nothing has happened since Judge Merrow's decision as a practical matter.
That is correct, Your Honor, and there has not been a special selection board. So it is exactly as it was. So it's sort of frozen in amber.
There's no money here. The Navy, even if we affirm, the Navy doesn't owe him any actual back pay, but it would, because of the retirement credits process, retirement and start paying him pension checks.
I'd have to go back. There was a calculation that produced a zero. Money judgment, the $0 money judgment as of the date of the calculation. And as you know, there are offsets for interim civilian earnings. We haven't performed an offset calculation from the date of judgment to this moment in time. So I can't quite answer your question. It may be that it's still zero.
Would you agree with the notion that mainly what this is about is a right to a pension? Retirement credits that would entitle him to a pension, and there may or may be some back pay cash, or maybe not.
With this footnote, Chief Judge, the footnote is that if he is and here I have to jump ahead and talk about relief, but it's just, this is as good a time as any. If this court, whatever else it does, directs that the BCNR, the Board for Correction of Naval Records, be required to evaluate under a proper analysis whether Mr. Barnes should have been promoted, not by operation of law, but as a matter of its Section 1552 authority to correct error or justice. In other words, not the operation of law concept. And if they determine that he would have been entitled to promotion to lieutenant commander, I would have to look into whether a lieutenant commander can serve more than 20 years. I'm getting a little bit into the granular.
I don't recall you asking for us to send this back to the board for correction of naval records. I thought your prayer for relief was, number one, rule that he's already been promoted to lieutenant commander, or at least, number two, restore him with back pay and retirement credits to his former rank of lieutenant. I didn't hear any number three or send it back to the correction board.
Let me give you the page references. If you look, Your Honor, on pages 46 and 47 of our main brief, and if you look on page 17 of our reply brief, we covered that contingency.
Where I normally look is at the end of the brief, where there's a section called Statement of Relief Sought, which is on page 51, and what you're now saying is not there.
It is on pages 16 and 46 and 47, and again, in the conclusion, Your Honor, of our reply brief. And it is a contingency that was clearly addressed, and if I can take 1 second, it probably...
You're entitled to relief that you first mentioned as what you're seeking in your reply.
Oh, of course not. It's on pages 46 and 47 of our main brief, Your Honor. And we cite the...
buried in...
It's
text.
No, it's not buried at all. It's right there.
I still can't find it.
Last line on page 46.
That's correct.
It's just a conclusion.
It's that paragraph. It's that paragraph, and we cite the Price case. So anyway, can I tell you how I think the remedies pieces fit together here? That may be productive. Obviously, we have a Dysart issue. Obviously, the full court has taken a position with respect to Dysart. Dr. Lewis's petition, time in which to apply for certiorari from the Supreme Court has not expired. I think I can safely say that a certiorari petition is likely to be filed. So that's where the Dysart issue stands, and we understand the circuit precedent with respect to panels being bound. So let's set Dysart aside. Obviously, we believe that Mr. Barnes is entitled to what let's call Dysart relief. Setting that aside, we do believe that Mr. Barnes should be restored to his grade of lieutenant and deemed retired as of his 20-year date, which we believe was in February of this year. That's the direct answer to your main question, Chief Judge. Second, as we indicated, and I sincerely apologize if a point that was mentioned on 46 and 47 didn't find its way into the conclusion of our brief. Certainly the government can't claim surprise. They read our brief, we read their brief. I think they weren't fair notice. In any event, we believe that the case, regardless of, or I should say, in addition to the core relief that Judge Merrow granted, should be remanded so that BCNR can respond on the question of the inconsistency in its own precedents. And Judge Merrow spent some time in response to our submission that the BCNR's decisions were all over the lot and the invocation
of
the
hands. I understood the final conclusion of Judge Merrow in the court below to be that he wasn't going to rule on the validity of the correction board determination.
It's true, he didn't.
So we don't have the trial court's ruling on review of the correction board. Doesn't that block us from taking a position on whether we think the correction board's ruled correctly or not?
No, and this is why. It was fully briefed. Judge Merrow found it unnecessary in circumstances to address that. It's a question of law. You would be reviewing it de novo anyway. I think the court could, and I think given the prolonged period this controversy has been in both administrative...
When you say it was fully briefed, do you mean in the briefs that we have to Judge Merrow?
Below.
Do we have the briefs below?
I assume you have the entire record.
I don't think so. We only have what you gave us in the joint appendix and the supplemental appendix in the back of your brief. I don't think we do have the brief that Judge Merrow had before him on the correctness of the correction board determination.
Well, all I can say is I believe this is an issue of law that this court can address in the first instance. I'm mindful that judges have an allergy to doing that. It's fine. If you feel it necessary, then you can send it back to Judge Merrill, and he'll decide that piece of it that he felt was unnecessary to decide at the time. Anyway, it's not worth spending a lot of...
Well, can I move you now to one of the merit issues that we discussed? Or
just with this one, yes. One tiny sentence that I have to say. There's another piece, which is Judge Merrill, in the judgment, directs that there be consideration by a special selection board for promotion to lieutenant commander. So if this is the way I see the decision tree proceeding, if the BCNR ultimately, when it's called upon, as I think it has to be, to sort out its precedents and explain why clean hands applies to Danny T. Barnes, but nobody else has a doctrine or reason for turning down relief. If the BCNR, in that process, for whatever reason, elects not to afford him a promotion to lieutenant commander, then it has to, under the judgment, refer the matter to a special selection board, which can make the determination in accordance with the special selection board statute. So anyway, that's the logic tree.
Yeah, can I ask you about, I mean, this goes back to what we were discussing with government counsel about this sort of post-Dicer relief, except right. That we're not going to overturn Dicer.
Sure.
And so I'm trying to understand really what the Court of Claims, how the Court of Claims thought that even given Dicer's requirement that the president has unfettered, unreviewable discretion to remove someone from the promotion list, you and Judge Miro think or thought that the way to get a relief for a procedural violation is to still say that even though he was validly removed from the promotion list, that ought not to count as one of two tassel things.
That's correct.
And why? I mean, how can you have one without the other? You're saying, yes, the president had the right to remove him. We're going to say that he was removed, but that somehow, because there were procedural violations, this doesn't count as a passover? I don't understand how you can get
it. Here's how. It seemed to me, and I'm reading Dysart, that the vice that the Dysart panel was concerned with was trenching on the president's authority with respect to appointments. The authority with respect to appointments is a question of remedy. That is a remedies question. It does not go to the antecedent question that counsel and the panel we were dealing with before about whether the statute had been violated in the first place. So if the vice in Dysart, which I fairly read, that's how I understand it, if the vice in Dysart was giving the president a wide berth in terms of who is to be promoted, that does not go to the question of whether a violation has occurred of the Defense Officer Personnel Management Act, Section 624, such that the non-promotion consequences can be sustained.
But
I
don't know what the rules are, but it seems to me there must be tons of rules that go to what's a passover. A passover being, therefore, when one is on a promotion list, removed from the promotion list, or not promoted. This, I would assume you agree, what happened here, in other words, his non-selection, his removal from the list in this first instance, comes within the definition of a passover.
By statute. But it's in this sense, actually, the way it works, Your Honor, there was a statute, I believe it's Section 632, subject to check, but there is a statute that takes a promotion, a selection for promotion, a blessing, and turns it into a curse, a passover. It does not call it a passover, but it says such a person is deemed to have been passed over, and then if there is a passover.
So how do we get around that in this instance? He wasn't selected. We all say that under Dicer, living under Dicer, there was no automatic promotion. The president had unfettered discretion to remove him from the list. But you're saying that that doesn't count as a real passover.
That's correct, because of the deficiencies in the Navy's administration of the delay procedure.
Well, that gets back to the point that I raised earlier, I think. And that is, it seems to me your argument is hinged on the delays, and that because there were delays, the removal from the promotion list was ineffective.
Your Honor,
it seems to me that in light of Dysart, the removal, if the president has unfettered discretion to remove someone from the list, then what What difference does it make whether the delays were proper or improper? He was removed from the list.
All right. Let me respond on a couple of levels. The first is that it is clear, and this goes back to a colloquy that I think Chief Judge Michel and Mr. Mickle had. It is suggested that a decision to remove is unreviewable. Let me respectfully suggest that that is incorrect, and here's why. Under an agency is bound, obviously, by its own regulations. Citations omitted. There is a Navy regulation found at 32 CFR section 732.3. This is cited in our brief, our main brief, page 43, footnote 26. That is the regulation that governs the Board for Correction of Naval Records, and it indicates that decisions are reviewable by the BCNR, even if they are decisions of the President. There is no question but that a decision, albeit one taken by or on behalf of the President, is reviewable by the BCNR. Step two in the syllogism. The Supreme Court instructs us in Chappell versus Wallace that the decisions of the BCNR are subject to review for the usual standards of review. If both of those things are true, then at least in a case, Your Honor, where the litigant has taken the trouble to invoke the correction board remedy, a remedy that this court does not require, but in such a case, that litigant is entitled to review of the BCNR's decision.
But you're not challenging here the decision to remove Lieutenant Barnes from the list.
Yes, we are.
Directly or indirectly. I understand the challenge to be that it was inappropriate because it did not occur during a valid period of delay. And because the delays are inappropriate, therefore the removal is inappropriate.
Judge Lynn, that is our position.
Okay. Well, then you are not attacking the propriety of the secretary acting at, by delegation from the president to remove. And if you're not attacking the decision to remove, then he was, to use the language of section 632A, he failed of selection. And therefore, that is one of the two passovers that resulted in his removal from the Navy.
We are attacking it, Your Honor. We've attacked it from the beginning. And let me
directly and not on the merits, though. You are attacking it only because it occurred during a period of delay, which you attack.
Well, that is our position. If I can, we spend some time struggling with this because it's an obvious question. I don't have a problem with your putting it to me.
That's a good thing.
I'm sorry?
That's a good thing.
Well, we try. If you look at our reply brief on page 16, we have a thing that goes into this to some extent. Basically, Your Honor, what you're arguing, or what you're, you know,
it's like the Supreme Court, everything's buried in a footnote.
In my next life, I'm going to try to discipline myself to write without footnotes. I seem to be unable to do it in this one.
We're not arguing, we're just having a problem.
Absolutely, and I'm appreciative for that. What you have suggested, Your Honor, is a version of a kind of inevitable removal approach. In other words, if the person is going to be removed anyway, why bother? Who cares about whether Section 624 was violated? And that is an analysis that the BCNR has not embraced. I don't want to go through that.
Well, why does that matter to us? Whether the BCNR decided to agree to that or not, your argument to us is that as a matter of law, a statutory requirement was not met. QED, everything downstream by the Navy officials was void.
That is correct. I think that it's a fair point to make that the world would have looked quite different to whoever made the decision to actually remove Mr. Barnes' name from the promotion list. Had there not been
is there any connection?
the grounds of removing him from the promotion list was fraternizing with enlisted women, including, I think, two who were under his direct supervision. That was the bad behavior that led the Navy officials to view him as not promotable. Now, that was all documented by December of 1997.
That's correct.
The March 1998 letter that you're complaining didn't get to Lieutenant Barnes fast enough couldn't add or subtract at all to the established misconduct involving fraternization. So when Secretary Danzig, a year later in April, if I recall the dates correctly, of 1998, said, I'm taking this guy off the promotion list, he's a bad apple, that decision is based on the 1997 inquiry and non-judicial punishment and all the records thereof. It doesn't seem to have anything to do at all with anything that transpired in March or April or May or August of 1998.
Except that the Navy, according to the administrative record, which is, we all know is quite voluminous, the Navy didn't take any steps in December of 1997 to get Mr. Danzig or whoever was in office at that time.
I mean, whether they acted very fast, moderately fast, kind of slow, horribly slow, what difference does that make? If Danzig's decision to remove Lieutenant Barnes from the promotion list was based on fraternization, what difference does it make whether there was a late notice in March? Because obviously Danzig's decision would have been the same whether the March 17th the letter was delivered immediately or a few weeks late or never. Danzig would have done exactly the same thing.
If that's the case, then Congress will have played a cruel joke on not only the Navy, but the other services and the personnel of those services in enacting Section 624D.
Not necessarily, because you could view the efficacy of 624 and some of the other statutes as providing for mandates to various people in the military services of what they're supposed to do, how they're supposed to do it, when they're supposed to do it, etc. And of course, they're all bound by that, and they can get in trouble if they don't follow those laws.
It's
something else to say that in passing 624 or the other statutes, Congress was trying to create ways that an officer could overpower the decisions of the Secretary of the Navy. So when you say Congress is playing a cruel joke to enact 1624, that's only true if the intent was to both direct the Navy how to behave and create enforceable rights that can cancel the removal. If the purpose of Congress is only the former, then the statute's not a hoax at all.
What is
your evidence that the passage of 624 was intended to create a ways to scuttle decisions of the president's designee?
I'll take a second and give you the sort of Tom Stoppard version of the Dysart argument. The statute 624 says shall be promoted. In 1980, when Congress passed the statute, but DOTMA, forgive me for the acronym, but when they passed that, even before the effective date, they hurried up and got a technical correction to include an out from the notification provision. And the out was to take account, this is an angry, the out was to take account of the possibility that you might not actually be able to find Mr. Fidel on March 31st, 1998.
And you read that as meaning, other than that delay, any other delay cancels what the president ordered?
Yes, because it doesn't, the entire statute, including the word shall, has to mean something. And I think to read them together, that's where it goes. Now, if I can briefly wrap it up.
That's a good idea.
One or two things that I came here willing to talk about, so let me, if you'll indulge me for a second. First of all, in our reply brief, we referred to the government's suggestion that the Restoration to Office Clause of the Tucker Act was unconstitutional. We have been advised by the Senate Legal Counsel's Office last month that they have no report of any, no record of any report having been filed by the Attorney General indicating that, as required, you may recall this from the end of our reply brief, indicating that the government had taken a position that restoration to office is unconstitutional. And this is a status report on that point in our brief. The second has to do with a point that Mr. Mickle mentioned. Congress did pass some provisions that affect sections 624 and 629 in the John W. Warner National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal 2007. I can give you the public law number. It's 109-364. In a nutshell, these provisions do not directly affect this case for a variety of reasons, including the effective date provisions. However, I would encourage the court to consult the Senate report, which is Senate Report 109-254, which does invoke the operation of law concept with respect to the president's power to remove names of officers from promotion lists prior to confirmation. Note that this and Dr. Lewis's case, and I think Dr. Dysart's case, are all post-confirmation cases.
And none of this is in any of your briefs?
No, because this all happened, this is very recent legislation, about which I learned
The only reason I'm asking is that the court, in fairness, might have to provide Mr. Mickle an opportunity to respond to these things that you're citing orally that you didn't put in your, even in your reply.
Right, because this was all after the...
But we have a procedure for post-reply brief developments to be brought to the attention of the court through formal filings prior to the argument date, which didn't happen.
Mr. Rickle is the party, is the counsel who mentioned the statute. He mentioned it first in his argument.
He's not relying on the Senate report that you're asking us to read and rely on. So you're putting new cards on the table orally in your argument, which is a little unfair, perhaps, to the other side.
I have no wish to be unfair to the other side.
And, well, we'll see if he needs some time to respond.
We do think that it is important that the BCNR be afforded an opportunity to explain itself.
Well, you covered that earlier, and I think we have that clearly in mind. That's part of your case. It is right in the reply brief and elsewhere in the red briefs.
If the panel has no further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. All right, Mr. Mickle, 3 minutes.
Your Honor, the site we refer the court to in Dysart, pursuant to Your Honor's suggestion, I actually was able to find it, thank you, was in 1317. And in that site on Dysart, it first discusses the quote is, Congress does not have the authority to require the president to exercise his appointment power. And then it also talks about this court's authority. And that's our site, our citation. And subject to any additional questions by the court.
And is your view that language you're citing is the holding of our Dysart decision, not what an old days law professor used to call a dicta, which is not part of the holding, not precedential. Right? You're saying that this cited language is part of the holding of the court in Dysart?
As the court wrote in Dysart, the
precedent. Well, the courts say lots of things. That's what dicta means.
Right.
Dicta is what the court says in the background, but it's not part of their decision. Okay. Therefore, it doesn't bind the future panels or anybody else.
That went to the heart of Dysart, because Dysart clearly was outside the timeline of six.
And you are saying it is the whole.
Yes, Your Honor. And subject to any additional questions, we'd ask the court of claims decision, the court of federal claims decision.
And you've answered Judge Brooks' question, for which we thank do you intend to make any response to Mr. Fidel's points that you didn't already cover in your initial argument?
No, Your Honor, because we believe that those were covered in our briefs.
All right, thank both counsel. The case was very thoroughly briefed, thoroughly argued. We shall take it under advisement.